That night before the Battle of Tamiat, I chose for them the Lament for Queen Lostris. This is one of my most famous compositions. They gathered around me at the campfire, and I sang for them all 150 verses. The best singers amongst them joined in the chorus, while the others hummed the refrain. At the end, there were very few dry eyes amongst my audience. My own tears did not detract in any way from the power and beauty of my performance. With the first glimmering of dawn the next day, our camp was astir. Now the men could strip off their Bedouin robes and headdresses and open the sacks that contained their Hyksos body armor and weapons. The armor was for the most part made of padded leather, but the helmets were bronze skull caps with a metal nosepiece. Every man was armed with a powerful recurved bow and a quiver of flint-headed arrows, which were fletched with coloured feathers in the Hyksos style. Their swords were carried in a scabbard, strapped to their backs, so the handle stood up behind their left shoulder, ready to hand. The bronze blades were not straight-edged as those of regular Egyptian weapons, but were curved in the Eastern fashion. The armour and weapons were too heavy and too hot to wear while they worked the oars in the direct sunlight. So the men stripped to their loincloths and laid their battle gear on the deck beneath the rowing benches between their feet. Most of my men were of light complexion, and many of them had fair hair. I ordered them to use soot from the cooking fires to darken their beards and skin until they were all as swarthy as any Hyksos legionnaire. When our three crowded galleys pushed off from the beach and rowed out of the bay, I was once again in the leading ship with Zaras. I stood beside the helmsman, who wielded the long steering oar in the stern. From the same merchant in the port of Ushu who had sold me the boats, I had also purchased a papyrus map which purported to set out the details of the southern shore of the Middle Sea between Gebel and Wadi al-Nilam. He claimed to have drawn this map with his own hand from his own observations. Now I spread it on the deck between my feet and anchored the corners with pebbles that I had picked up on the beach. Almost at once I was able to identify some of the features on the shore. It seemed that my chart was gratifyingly accurate. Twice during the morning we spotted the sails of other vessels on the horizon, but we sheered off and gave them a wide berth. Then, when the sun was directly overhead, the lookout in the bows shouted another warning and pointed ahead. I shaded my eyes and peered in the direction he was indicating. I was astonished to see the surface of the sea along the entire horizon was churning white water as though a heavy squall were bearing down on us. This was not the season of storms. "Get the sails down," I snapped at Zaras. "Ship oars and have the sea anchors rigged by the bows and ready for streaming." The furious waters raced towards us, and we braced ourselves for the onslaught of the wind. The white water emitted a mounting roar as it approached. I took a firm grip on the wooden combing of the hatch in front of me and braced myself. Then the seething water enveloped the hull. The uproar became deafening, with men shouting orders and oaths and the waters dashing against the ship's sides. However, to my astonishment, there was no wind. I knew at once that this storm without wind was a supernatural phenomenon. I closed my eyes and began to chant a prayer to the great god Horus for his protection, and I clung to the combing with both hands. Then there was a hand upon my shoulder, shaking me rudely, and a voice shouting in my ear. I knew it was Zaras, but I refused to open my eyes. I waited for the gods to dispose of me as they saw fit. But Zaras kept shaking me, and I remained alive. I opened my eyes cautiously, but I kept on praying under my breath. Now I realized what Zaras was saying to me, and I risked a quick glance over the side. The sea was alive, with enormous, gleaming bodies that were shaped like arrowheads. Again, it took me a moment to realize that they were living creatures, and that each of them was at least the size of a horse. However, These were gigantic fish. They were packed so densely that those below were forcing the others to surface in a tumult of waves and spray, their multitudes stretched to the limit of the eye. "Tuna!" Zaras was yelling at me. "These are tuna fish!" Upper Egypt is a landlocked country, so I have never had the opportunity to spend enough time on the open sea to have witnessed a tuna migration of this magnitude. I had read so much about the subject that I should have known what was happening. I realized that I was in danger of looking ridiculous, so I opened my eyes and yelled as loudly as Zaras, "Of course they're tuna! Get the harpoons ready!" I had noticed the harpoons when I came aboard for the first time. They were stowed under the rowing benches. I had supposed that they were used to repel pirates and corsairs if they tried to board the ship. The shafts were about twice as long as a tall man. The heads were of razor-sharp flint. There was an eye behind the barb to which the coil line was spliced. At the other end of the line was tied a carved and wooded float. Although I had given the order for harpoons, it was typical of Zaras that he was the first of any of them to act upon it. He always led by his own example. He snatched one of the long weapons from where it had been strapped under the thwart, and as he ran with it to the ship's side, he unwrapped the retaining line. He jumped up on the gunwale of the galley and balanced the long harpoon easily, with the shaft resting on his shoulder and the barbed flint head pointing down at the flashing shoal of fish that was streaming past him like a river of molten silver. They looked up at him with great round eyes that seemed to be dilated with terror. I watched him gather himself and then hurl the harpoon, point first, straight down into the water below him. The shaft of the heavy weapon shuddered as the point struck, and the harpoon was whipped away below the surface by the rush of the huge fish that was impaled by the flint point. Zaras jumped back onto the deck and seized the running line as it streamed away, blurring with speed and beginning to smoke with the friction of the coarse rope against the wood of the gunwale. Three other men of the crew leapt forward to help him, and they latched onto the rope and battled to subdue the fish and bring it alongside. Four other men had followed Zaras' example, and each of them grabbed a harpoon from its place below the thwarts and ran with it to the gunwale. Soon there were knots of struggling men on each side of the boat, shouting with excitement, swearing and bellowing incoherent orders at each other as they struggled with the massive creatures. One after another, the fish were heaved on board and clubbed to death. Before the last of the harpooned fish had been killed and butchered, the rest of the mighty shoal had disappeared back into the depths as suddenly and miraculously as they had appeared. We went ashore again that night, and by the light of the cooking fires on the beach, we feasted on the succulent flesh of the tuna. It is the most highly prized delicacy in all the seas. The men seasoned the flesh with just a little salt. Some of them could not wait for it to be thrown on the coals, and they wolfed it down raw and bleeding. Then they followed it with a swallow from the wineskins. I knew that the next morning they would be strong and eager for the first sight of the enemy. Unlike corn or other insipid foods, meat rouses the demon in the heart of a warrior. So that night I sang for them the ballad of Tanus and the Blue Sword. It is the battle hymn of the blues, and it set them afire. Every man joined in the chorus, no matter how rough his voice, and afterwards I could see the light of war shining in their eyes. They were ready to meet any enemy. We launched the galleys again the next morning, as soon as it was light enough to make out the reefs below the surface and to find a safe passage through them. The closer we came to the many mouths of the Nile Delta, the more certain I became of our position, until in the late afternoon we sailed past an estuarine mouth which was bounded on the east side by a low, forested headland and on the west by an exposed mud bank. On the headland, facing the sea, stood a rudimentary tower of mud bricks that were painted with lime wash. The roof of the tower had collapsed as had most of the wall on the seaward side of the construction. However, enough of it was still standing for me to be certain that this was the navigational marker for the Tamiat Channel, probably erected there by some long-dead Egyptian mariner. I ran to the foot of the single mast and clambered up it until I reached the sloping yard of the lateen sail. I wrapped my legs around it and hugged the mainmast. From this vantage, I had a clear view inland, and I immediately picked up the square outline of a man-made structure which just showed above the treetops far inland. Like the channel marker, it also was painted with lime wash. I was in no doubt at all that this was the watchtower of the Minoan trade fort and treasury which we were seeking. I slid back down the yard, and as my feet hit the deck, I shouted to the helmsman, "Put up your helm! Turn 3 points to starboard!" Zara strode across to where I stood. "Yes?" he asked. Usually he is genial and gregarious, but at a time such as this he becomes a man of quick decisions and even quicker reactions. "Yes," I agreed, and he gave a brief cold smile and a curt nod to the helm to confirm my order. We turned out towards the open sea. The other two galleys followed us around. Now we headed obliquely away from the shore. However, as soon as we passed the next headland and were screened from the surveillance of any sentry on the tower of the Tamiat fortress, I ordered another change of course. We headed back directly towards the labyrinthine swamps of the delta. I knew from my map where to find what looked to be a secure anchorage. We lowered the masts and laid them flat on the decks while we poled our way through the dense banks of papyrus and bulrushes into the sheltered lagoon that I had chosen. Here we were completely screened by dense vegetation. We anchored a boat's length apart in the shallow, murky water, with our keels only just clear of the mud at the bottom. We were able to wade between the boats with the water at the deepest parts of the lagoon reaching only as high as our chins. While we watched the sun set and the moon rise, the men feasted on what remained of the smoked tuna steaks. Zaras waded quietly from galley to galley, selecting 8 of his best men and warning them to be ready before sunrise the next morning to accompany us on a reconnaissance. An hour before dawn, we crowded into 2 of the skiffs that we had towed behind the galleys. We paddled across the wide lagoon to the shore nearest the headland on which I had spotted the watchtower of the fort. I could hear the cries of swamp birds and the susurration of their wings passing over us in the darkness. As the light strengthened, I could make out the long, flighting lines of waterfowl and their arrowhead formations against the brightening sky. There were wild ducks and geese, storks, herons, cranes with long necks and trailing legs, ibis and egrets, and 50 or more other species. They rose in huge flocks from the surface of the lagoon as we rode through them. At last, the sun pushed itself above the horizon, and the vast expanses of the delta around us were revealed. It is a wild and desolate place, unfit for human habitation. We had to drag the skiffs through the shallows and hide them in the reeds when we at last reached firmer ground. I was uncertain of the layout of the fort and its surroundings, so we groped our way through the dense stands of reeds and bulrushes ever more cautiously. Abruptly, we came out upon the bank of a deep channel which cut through the papyrus beds from the south in the direction of the open waters of the Middle Sea. It was about 150 paces wide, and I could see that it was too deep to wade. On the opposite bank of the channel, I was able to make out the flat roof of the watchtower we had spotted the previous day. The helmeted heads of at least 3 of the guards were showing above the parapet as they patrolled their beats. Suddenly, I heard the unmistakable sounds of a moving vessel coming up the channel from the seaward direction of where we lay, and I cautioned my companions to silence. The creaking of the rigging, the voice of the seamen, chanting the soundings in the bows, and the thud of the oars in the rowlocks increased in volume until suddenly an enormous sea-going vessel appeared around the bend in the channel. I had never seen a ship of this type or size before. However, I knew from descriptions that my spies had sent me that this was a Cretan trireme. She was both a cargo vessel and a warship. She was triple-decked with three banks of oars. Her long, pointed bows were reinforced with sheets of beaten bronze for ramming enemy ships. She had two masts, which would enable her to spread a goodly area of sail, although these were now furled as she threaded the narrow channel under oars. She was a lovely vessel, with long, clean lines and a high transom. Looking at her, it was not difficult to understand why Crete was the preeminent naval power of the world. This was the fastest and most powerful ship on all the seas. Even though she was heavily burdened and low in the water, no other vessel could challenge her. Nevertheless, I wondered what cargo she carried in her holds. As she drew level with where we lay hidden in the reed beds, I was able to study her officers. There were three of them in the stern, standing aside from the four crewmen who were manipulating the long steering oar. Although the cheek pieces of their armour masked most of their features, they seemed to be taller and more robust than our average Egyptian. I could see that their kilts were of the finest linen, and that their weapons were lovingly polished and engraved. These were more warriors than they were merchants. As she passed us, the breeze wafted the stench of the ship to where we lay. I knew that her upper bank of long oars was rowed by her crew, who were fighting men more than they were beasts of burden. At an order from their captain, they could jump up from the rowing bench and seize their weapons, which lay at their feet. They would fight like men and share in the prize money. However, the lower banks of oars were pulled by slaves who were shackled to the deck timbers. The stench I smelled was that of these unfortunates who would live their whole lives on the benches. They would row, sleep, eat, defecate, and ultimately die where they sat. The Cretan galley swept on past us, and then we heard the shouted orders of her officers. The upper bank of oars rose from the water like the wings of a silver seagull, and they were shipped, and only the lower banks continued dipping and pulling delicately as the ship turned into the final bend of the channel, heading towards the glistening white walls of the fortress, which showed in the distance above the nodding heads of the papyrus banks. Then, a most extraordinary event occurred, something for which I was completely unprepared. A second ship, almost identical in every respect to the first, rounded the bend of the channel and rowed past where we lay. She also was low in the water, carrying a weighty cargo. Then, to my utter astonishment and delight, a third, heavily burdened trireme came down the channel and sailed past us. She followed her two sister ships towards the fort. I realized what had happened. 3 months previously, I had been informed by my agents that the three treasure ships were prepared to sail from the principal Cretan port of Agapha. However, it had taken many months for this information to reach me. In the meantime, the departure of the convoy must have been delayed by unforeseen circumstances, the most probable reason being unfavorable weather conditions. My agents had been unable to warn me timeously of this delay. I had expected to reach the Tamiat fort only long after the convoy had arrived, discharged its cargo, and departed again on its return voyage to Agapha. The chances of me arriving at Tamiat at exactly the same time as the treasure convoy was so remote that it must have been arranged by divine intervention. From an early age, I have known that I am a favourite of the gods, particularly of the great god Horus, to whom I pray. How else could I have been gifted from birth with so many talents and virtues? How else have I been able to survive so many terrible perils and mortal dangers that would certainly have destroyed any lesser being? How else have I been able to stay so young and handsome and my mind so sharp, when all those about me wrinkle, turn grey, and fade away with age. There is something about me that has set me aside from most other mortal men." This was yet another example of Horace's favour and indulgence. I whispered my thanks to him, and swore that I would make a lavish sacrifice to him at the very first opportunity. Then I crawled closer to where Zaras lay, and tugged his sleeve. "I must cross this channel, and get closer to the Cretan fort," I told him. There are two enigmas in our very Egypt that I have never been able to come to terms with. The first is that although we use the horse as a beast of burden, and the chariot as our primary weapon of war, almost no Egyptian will ride astride. The second enigma is that although we live on the banks of a mighty river, almost no Egyptian is able to swim. If you ask one of them why this is so, they will usually shrug and answer, "The gods frown upon such uncouth behaviour." I have already asserted that I am different from most others. I hesitate to suggest that I am in any way superior. I think it is sufficient to point out that I am both an expert horseman and a strong and tireless swimmer. I knew that Zaras had neither of these skills, although, to give him full credit, I have never seen him bested when he had the reins of a chariot in his hands. Thus, I had ordered him to bring with him a buoy made from the bark of the cork tree to keep him afloat. The two of us stripped to our breech clouts and entered the channel. Zaras had his sword strapped to the cork float. I carried mine on my back. Zaras blew and puffed like a bull hippo, while I swam like an otter and reached the far bank of the channel before he was halfway across. When he managed to complete the crossing, I helped him ashore. Then, when he had regained his breath, we crept stealthily through the reeds towards the Cretan fort. When we reached a position from which we had a good view of the building, I realized why the Cretans had selected this site. It was on the highest point of a narrow ridge of limestone, which poked up through the soft alluvial soils and provided a strong foundation on which they had anchored their fortress. This limestone intrusion divided the flow of the main channel to form a moat around the fort. There were a number of different types of vessels anchored in the basin formed by the sweep of the river around the fortress. Most of these craft were mere barges, which I presumed the Cretans had used to carry building materials. There was not a single sea-going ship amongst them. The exception to this was the squadron of three magnificent triremes, which had rowed past our hiding place earlier. These were not anchored in the basin, but were already moored to the stone wharf directly below the main gate of the Tamiat fortress. The gate stood wide open, and there was a gathering of uniformed soldiers on the wharf to welcome the new arrivals. I could see by the plumed helmets and gold decoration they sported that many of these were high-ranking officers. In the time that it had taken Zaras and me to swim across the channel and reach our present position, the crews had opened the hatches of the leading trireme, and a chain gang of half-naked slaves was beginning the task of unloading her cargo. The slaves were working under the charge of a number of overseers, who wore half-armour and short swords on their belts. All of them wielded whips of plaited rawhide. The slaves were carrying a succession of identical wooden chests ashore over the gangplanks. Although the chests were not very large, they were obviously heavy, for the slaves staggered under the weight. The whole unloading process moved too slowly for the satisfaction of the overseers, who harangued and ranted at the working gang. As we watched, one of the slaves lost his footing while stepping from the gangplank to the wharf. He fell heavily and dropped the chest he was balancing on his head. It crashed to the stone slabs and burst open. I felt my heart jump against my ribs as I saw the brilliant flash of sunlight reflected from the metallic surfaces of the silver ingots as they spilled out in a heap onto the wharf. The bars were small and rectangular, no longer than a man's hand. However, there were 20 or more of them packed into the chest. A single chest of these bars would most likely have been sufficient to pay for the building of the great trireme which had carried it across the Middle Sea. All my hopes and expectations had been fulfilled. Here was the vast treasure that I had anticipated. Three of the overseers gathered around the prostrate slave and wielded their whips with gusto, swinging the lashes from high above their heads to crack against his sweat-shiny skin. The man screamed and writhed and tried to cover his head with his arms. One of the lashes caught him in the face and popped his right eyeball out of its socket. It dangled on its optic cord against his cheek, and he rolled his head from side to side. At last the slave lay unconscious, no longer able to protect himself. One of his tormentors stooped and grabbed his heels, dragged him on his back to the edge of the wharf, and then heaved him over the side. The body splashed into the river and sank swiftly, disappearing below the muddy surface. On the wharf the other slaves responded at once to the shouts of the overseers and the cracking of their whiplashes. The file of half-naked men began to move again, tottering under their burdens as though the work had never been interrupted. I tapped Zarah's shoulder to get his attention, and then we both crawled back deeper into the reed beds. Once we were safely hidden, I led him around to the far side of the fort and the bank of the other branch of the river. It took me an hour or so of cautious and careful manoeuvring before I could find a vantage point from which I was able to overlook the strategic layout of the fort and its surroundings. Now I was able to verify in person the reports I had received from my spies. Although the walls of the fort were formidable, and probably even impregnable, the area they enclosed was not very large. There was a severely limited amount of space on the ridge, insufficient for anything more than the treasury alone, and barracks to house a detachment of guards to beat off any attempt to land by a small raiding party coming up one of the channels from the sea. However, the Cretans must also have realized that they required a much larger force of several thousand men on hand to oppose any larger enemy force that might land on the coast and march inland to mount a more determined attack on the fort. They had solved this problem by stringing a pontoon bridge across both channels of the river, so that the fort, sitting on the island in the centre of the river, could be reached swiftly by defending Cretan troops from either bank. From where I lay, I had a good view across the most easterly channel to the flat, dry ground beyond. This was where the Cretans had built their fortified camp, which provided barracks for the main body of their army. They had surrounded the camp with a protective palisade of sharpened logs, which stood twice the height of a man. I calculated that this camp would be capable of housing 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers. There was a watchtower at each corner of the square enclosure, and I could see that the roofs of the buildings within the palisade were plastered thickly with black mud from the riverbank, which had dried hard. These would afford protection from the fire arrows that an enemy might shoot over the walls. From the gate in the wall closest to the river, the Cretans had built a passageway of dried black mud bricks to the head of the pontoon bridge. This would protect their troops from enemy arrows when they sallied forth from the camp. They had used a series of longboats anchored side by side across both channels of the river to serve as the pontoons for their bridge. Over these they had laid a causeway of hewn planks. This bridge ensured that large numbers of troops could be rushed from the camp to wherever they were needed most. "They have planned it all thoroughly," Zarath gave his opinion as he surveyed the fortifications. "This is what the Cretans are most famous for, thoroughness," I agreed. But I was still studying the ground, seeking out any weakness in the Cretan defences. Search as I might, I could find only one. That was the pontoon bridge itself. But I was confident that I could deal with that. I switched my attention back to the wharf, where the three great triremes still lay moored. I considered the manner in which the Cretans were unloading the cargo of the first ship. I could see that it was not very efficient. If I were presented with this task, I would rig tripods and pulleys over the open hatches and hoist the chests of silver up to the deck level on pallets. There I would have carts ready to trundle the chests across the wharf and into the gates of the fort. The Cretan slaves were manhandling each chest individually up the ladder from the bottom of the hold to the main deck. At this rate, it would take several days to unload each ship. I was worried. I had not truly recognized the immensity of my own task until I saw it laid out before me. It was one thing to speak lightly of handling hundreds of lakhs of bullion, but it became entirely another matter when I was presented with the physical weight and bulk of such a treasure, and the problem of seizing it and transporting it hundreds of leagues over sea and mountain and desert while being pursued by a vengeful army. I began to worry that I had taken on an impossible task, and thought dismally that perhaps the only solution, if I was ever able to get my hands on such a vast cargo, was to take it out into the deep waters of the Middle Sea and to dump it overboard, where it would be forever beyond the reach of both King Beorn and the supreme Minos. Then I would flee with all my men who had survived the wrath of the Cretans back to the safety of Thebes. Perhaps the supreme Minos could then be persuaded that King Beorn was the culprit, but I doubted it. The solution did not come to me at once, and even I had to wrestle with the problem for almost an hour while Zaras and I lay there in the papyrus beds. Then, suddenly, the solution struck me like a thunderbolt. It was so ingenious that even I was stunned by the beauty of it. I thought I would explain it all to Zaras, but then I decided not to overpower him with something so simple and yet so devilishly complex. I looked up at the sun. It had reached its zenith some time ago and was already halfway down the sky again. I looked back at the trio of treasure ships, and I think I grinned. I sensed that Zaras was watching me intently. I think he knew that I was onto something at last, and he was waiting eagerly for my orders, which I was not yet ready to reveal to him. "Enough," I told him. "We must go." "Where to, Taita?" "Back to the boats. We have a great deal of work to do before nightfall." The sun was setting when at last Zaras and I managed to swim and wade back to where we had left our three small boats in the lagoon. The men were overjoyed to see us again. I think they had convinced themselves that we had been discovered and killed by the enemy, leaving them leaderless and thrown back on their own limited resources. They scrambled to obey my orders. The first of the many challenges facing me was to get every single one of my heavily armed and armoured men, almost none of whom were able to swim, across the deep channels of the river to reach the fort. To this end, I selected the smallest and lightest of our three boats. Then I made the men strip the ropes and other useful loose items from the remaining two hulls. I thought of burning these, but the Cretans would surely have seen the smoke and sent men to investigate it. Instead, I ordered my men to knock the bottoms out of them and scuttle them in the deepest part of the lagoon. Then we dragged the single boat that I had selected through the shallow waters to the eastern bank of the lagoon nearest the fort. From there, I needed every single one of my men to manhandle it across the dry ground to the river channel. I ordered them to attach the anchor ropes that we had salvaged from the two scuttled boats to the bows of this one that we had retrieved. With 100 men hauling on each rope, the keel of the boat acted as a skid, and the hull slid readily enough over the papyrus stalks, which were flattened beneath its weight. Nevertheless, we had almost half a league of dry ground to cover before we reached the main channel of the river. By that time, it was close to midnight, and the waxing gibbous moon was high in the sky. I allowed the men a short time to rest on the river bank and to don their armour and to wolf down a cold meal. Then, with muffled oars and carrying 50 men at each crossing, we began to ferry them over the channel. When every one of them was across, I divided our little force into two groups. The larger group of 150 men I sent with Zaras to creep through the reed beds until they were as close to the main gate of the fort as possible without being in danger of discovery by the sentries. They were to conceal themselves there until they received my signal. Before we parted, I explained to Zaras what I planned. I would row up the channel with a crew of 50 men. My intention was to attack and destroy the pontoon bridge, which connected the main enemy camp to the island on which the treasury stood. Before we parted company, I embraced Zaras briefly, and I repeated my orders to him so that there could be no misunderstanding. Then I sent him away, while I clambered on board the waiting galley and gave the order to my rowers to ply the oars. The current was swift and strong, but my men heaved away lustily, and, hugging the banks of the channel furthest from the fort, we made good speed upstream. Soon we could see the lime-washed tower of the fort gleaming in the moonlight. The sight encouraged my oarsmen to still greater effort. We came around the final bend in the channel, and the fort lay before us. The three triremes were, as I had last seen them, moored against the stone wharf. The moonlight was bright enough for me to make out that two of them were still riding low in the water, still fully laden with their cargoes of bullion. The third trireme was standing a little higher. Much of her cargo must have been unloaded. Nevertheless, I estimated that she still had more than half her load of treasure chests in her holds. There were no Cretan sentries anywhere in sight. There were no lights showing aboard any of the great ships. However, there was a fire glowing at one end of the wharf, and there were torches burning in brackets on each side of the gates of the fort. I lifted the bronze helmet from my head and placed it on my lap. Then I adjusted the bright yellow cloth that was knotted around my throat to mask the lower half of my face. This is an extraordinary type of cloth known as silk. It is extremely rare and worth 100 times its own weight in silver. It comes from a land at the edge of the world where it is spun not by men, but by worms. It is possessed of magical powers. It can turn away evil spells and such diseases as the plague and the yellow flowers. However, now I used it simply to hide my face. My features are so distinctive that there is always a strong possibility that they will be recognized by either friend or foe. Beauty comes at a price. After that of Pharaoh himself, my face is probably the best known in the civilized world, by which I mean Egypt. When I replaced my helmet, I was faceless in the ranks of faceless men. As we rode closer to the wharf, the torch flames threw just sufficient flickering light for me to make out the blanket-wrapped forms of the sentries crouching close to the warmth of their watch-fires. It was obvious to me that the Cretan officers had not wished to spend the night in the crowded fort with all their men. At nightfall, they must have gone back across the bridge with the majority of their men to the comforts of their elaborate camp on the further bank of the channel. This suited my purpose well enough. Still keeping as far from the wharf as the channel allowed, we rowed quietly past the moored galleys and the looming walls of the fort. As we left those behind, I could make out ahead of us the row of longboats that formed the pontoon bridge strung out across the channel. We rowed up on the main channel until I judged we were at least 200 yards upstream of the pontoon bridge. Then I turned our boat across the current, and I aimed our bows at the centre of the long, narrow pontoon bridge. I gave a quiet order to the rowers to stop heaving and to ship their oars, and we let the current run us down on the centre of the bridge. At the last moment I put the helm over, and we turned broadside to the bridge and came to rest with our starboard side pressed by the current hard against the causeway. My men were ready for this. 2 small groups of 3 men each jumped from the bows and stern of our ship and made her fast to the bridge. The rest of them, armed with axes and swords, swarmed over the ship's side onto the pontoons. Without waiting for further orders, they began to chop at the ropes that secured the line of longboats to each other. The sounds of the blows had certainly carried across the channel to the camp on the far bank, for almost at once we heard the Cretan drums start to beat and the call to arms. Pandemonium broke out in the camp. The shouted orders of the sergeants, the clatter and clash of arms on shields, the rattle of armour, and the clamour of the drums carried back to us. Then the flare of light as the torches were lit, and the reflection of their flames sparkled off the polished metal of shields and breastplates. A long column of trotting infantry burst out of the mouth of the passageway that led from the palisade wall of the camp to the head of the pontoon bridge. Four abreast, the Cretans charged out onto the narrow bridge, and it heaved and rocked under the stamping of their metal-studded sandals. Swiftly, the enemy front rank bore down upon our wrecking team, which was revealed by the glare of the torches. Still, the mooring ropes between the pontoons resisted the axe blows of my men. When only 50 paces separated them, I heard one of the officers who led the charge shout an order. I did not understand the language, but the meaning was immediately clear. Without checking their rush along the causeway, the leading Cretan infantrymen heaved back and then hurled a volley of spears. The heavy missiles fell amongst the team of my men, who were still hacking at the bindings that held together the line of longboats. I saw a javelin strike one of my fellows in the back and transfix him, so that the point emerged a good yard from his chest. He toppled over the side of the longboat on which he was balancing, and was sucked down into the black waters. None of his comrades even glanced up from their task. Grimly, they continued swinging their axes at the hempen ropes that bound the pontoons together. I heard a sharp report as a rope parted, and then the grinding and crackling of timbers of the hulls bearing against each other, as more of the lines holding the longboats together gave way. Then at last the bridge was cleaved asunder. But the two disjointed halves were still held together by our own ship, which was strung between them. I found myself screaming wildly at my axe men to come back on board. Of course, I was not troubled for my own safety. My only concern was for the safety of my brave lads. The torrent of armoured Cretans came on unchecked over the pontoons. They rushed at us in a solid phalanx, bellowing their challenges and hurling their javelins. My own men were scrambling back into our little boat and cowering down as the missiles slammed into the timbers of our hull. Now I was shouting for someone to sever the ropes that still locked our vessel into the centre of the bridge. In the uproar, my orders were drowned out. I could not make myself heard. I grabbed an axe from one of my men who was crouching in the bilges and ran to the bows. A Cretan came at me down the causeway. Both of us reached the bows at the same time. He had thrown his javelin and was struggling to unsheath his sword, which seemed to be jammed in its scabbard. It came free as we met each other. I could see that he was grinning under his helmet. He thought that he had me at his mercy, and that he was about to kill me. He drew back his sword and aimed a thrust at my chest, but I had seen his eyes move, signalling his intention, so I was able to anticipate the blow. I twisted my body, and the point of his sword flew under my armpit. I locked my arm over his elbow. Now I had him fully extended. He tried to pull free, but the causeway heaved under him, throwing him off balance. At that critical moment, I released the lock I had on his sword arm. He was unprepared for that, and he tottered backwards, extending both arms towards me as he tried to regain his balance. I swung my axe, aiming at the only part of his body that was not covered with metal, the wrist of his sword hand. I was also unbalanced in the rocking and heaving boat, so it was not a perfect stroke. It did not sever his sword hand cleanly, as I intended, but it slashed down to the bone on the inside of his wrist. I heard the tendons pop as they parted. His fingers opened involuntarily, and the sword fell from them and rattled on the planks of the bridge. He reeled backwards into one of his companions, who was crowding up behind him. Clinging to each other, the two of them went over the side of the bridge and hit the surface of the water with a tall splash. The weight of their armour dragged them under immediately. The axe was still in my hands, and the two mooring lines that secured the bows of our ship to the pontoon bridge were stretched in front of me so tightly that the water was spurting out of the twists of the rope. I lifted the axe above my head and then swung down, aiming it at the thicker of the two ropes, putting all my weight and power into this stroke. The rope parted with a snap like a bowstring. Our boat canted over sharply as the full weight was thrown onto the single, thinner rope. I swung again, and that rope jumped apart, twisting and unravelling in midair. The bows of our boat bobbed up as the weight and drag were taken off them, and we swung free across the current. The effect on the bridge was far more dramatic. Each of the segments of the bridge were still firmly attached to their moorings on the river banks. However, in the middle of the channel, they were no longer bound together, and the current snatched them apart swiftly. I watched as the dense pack of cretons was thrown about by the causeway, bobbing and lunging wildly under their feet. Their shifting weight intensified the instability of the floating pontoons. Men in heavy armour lost their balance and staggered about drunkenly, barging into each other, throwing each other overboard. I watched in horror as one of the pontoons capsized and a score of men were hurled over the side. Within minutes, the greater part of the Cretan horde was struggling in the dark waters and drowning like rats in the bottom of a well. What made it more tragic for me was that these were not even our enemies. All this destruction I had deliberately engineered to trick them into becoming our allies. It gave me very little consolation to know that I had done this for my very Egypt and for my Pharaoh. I was appalled by the consequences of my actions. Then, with an enormous effort of will, I thrust aside my guilt and remorse. I knew what had been done could not be undone. I tried to put the drowned men out of my mind, and thought instead about my own people and the losses that we had suffered. I forced myself to turn away and pushed my way back to where I cut the line that held us attached. I was shouting at my crew, taking out my anger on them, roaring at them to take up their oars again, shoving them back to the rowing benches, kicking and slapping those who hesitated in bewilderment. At last, I had the steering oar in my hands again, and the men were beginning to pull in unison. I put the helm over and steered us back towards the stone wharf under the main gate of the fort, where the treasure ships were moored.